Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
Want to describe what you're doing, Gloria?
I'm clipping her chin whiskers because it's not nice to be a girl with whiskers. There's something so unfeminine about a bearded lady.
I've always found them appealing myself. You ready for this, Star? Can you make a noise for me? This bearded lady is a horse. Her name is Star, and the woman giving Star a haircut is Gloria.
Oh, I'm Gloria Safera, and I've been part of this farm for my whole life, and I'm 80.
And I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and we're here to learn a little bit of the history of this very unique spot right smack in the middle of the south end of Seattle. How many other large animal farms are there in the city?
None.
You're it.
We're it.
This 20-acre farm in South Seattle is home to more than a dozen horses, and you can walk from these green pastures right to the light rail station or shopping in Seattle's Rainier Beach neighborhood. When Gloria's grandparents settled this land back in 1919, it was mostly woods.
And then it was less rural when I got married, which was about 1960. And they had a 4-H club. They had some dad who built an arena on the power line so the children could practice their riding. And there were horses all over here.
So does growing up on the mean streets of Seattle make these horses a little tougher than your average country horse?
No, it makes them a little more sophisticated. Oh, and they're much safer because nothing bugs them. They've already seen that. And usually what they do is they're very good copycat animals. So if you have a young horse and you take it with an older horse, the young horse goes, "I think I just saw the Sasquatch." And the other older horse goes, "It's a Halloween costume." And the younger horse goes, "Oh, that's okay."
I understand you took a memorable trip on Halloween last year.
Oh, yes. We humiliated my grandson, who is a pledge in the Fiji house at the University of Washington, by unloading our horses at Green Lake and riding up a grass median that takes you all the way to Greek Row. And when he saw us ride up to his fraternity house, he was mortified. He was just going, "I do not know these two women, my mother and my grandmother. They're insane people." And then classes were letting out. So all these kids are coming across the street. And many of them are very, very cute girls heading for their sorority houses. And they're stopping and saying, "Can we pet the horses?" My grandson was no longer quite so humiliated as he would say, "Of course you can pet the horses. And what house are you in? And what is your phone number, honey?"
For a proper view of this horse farm, you really have to see it from atop a horse. So Gloria invites me to hop up on Star, the mare who was getting a shave earlier. Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing, who is way more horsey than me, gives me a leg up.
Have you gotten onto a horse?
It's been quite a while, but I think I get the basic principle.
Just swing your leg over and I've got her. She's not going anywhere. You wild beast.
Well, Gabriel Spitzer here, coming at you from atop Star, the chestnut mare. I wanted to tell you that today on Sound Effect, our theme is city slickers. We are going to talk about what it's like for urban dwellers to make it in the country and what it's like to build the city from scratch out in the middle of nowhere. It's all coming up on Sound Effect, so don't go away. Let's go, Star. Yeah. Now a story of two city slickers and how they became the talk of a small town. If you were in eastern Washington's Metau Valley last year, in the weeks between Christmas and New Year's, you probably heard about this. You couldn't go into a grocery store or a bar or a trailhead without hearing about Sasha and Bozzy. You see, Sasha and Bozzy were lost in the woods. Before this, they had been just two happy,
poodles living in Tacoma with their owners, Jerry and Beverly Walker. Then over the holidays, the Walkers and their daughter Darcy drove to the valley for a white Christmas full of cross-country skiing. On the morning of December 22nd, it was bitter cold. The Walkers were gliding through their favorite ski park. Darcy was up ahead of her parents with the dogs by her side. And then suddenly, Sasha and Bozzy spotted some deer.
I see them jump, turn around, and go farther up the trail around the curve, and that was the last point at which I saw them.
The Walkers looked for hours, but by sundown, there was still no sign of the dogs. And the bitter day was turning into a frigid night. As Beverly remembers it, it was snowing, and the thermometer was showing temperatures in the single digits.
I got up in the middle of the night to look out the window to see the snow showers and to know that they were out there somewhere and not knowing where they were. And then to get up in the morning and not have them and to know the only thing that we could possibly do is get out there and look for them.
The second full day, we walk into the woods and we're calling their names and whistling, and I just stopped walking and I completely broke down. And it was at that point that it was just like, what are we doing? It's so cold. How could they possibly be alive? This is just absurd.
What I didn't tell Darcy was just a few minutes beforehand, I was a few steps behind her. I was looking at tracks and I realized it was probably a cougar track. If you can picture this, it was Christmas week. The place was crawling with skiers and snowshoers, and almost without exception, everyone I ran into knew about the poodles, and many of them were actually looking as well. People in cars would drive up and say to me, "We don't have anything to do today. We live here and we heard about the dogs and we want to help you look. Where do you think we should go? Where have you not looked?"
I was told by someone that has a business of rescuing dogs that you should leave some of your clothing there, so if they come back to that area, they'll realize that you've been there and stay there. So that's what we did. We didn't camp out, but we were in the car.
Jerry thought maybe if we actually cooked some meat, something to even enhance the scent, that would be a good idea. But this was Christmas Eve when we got the suggestion. So, of course, there's nothing open, and we're not meat eaters, so we didn't even have any meat. So I'm feeling so desperate to find my dogs that if anybody who drove into the parking lot, I would tell them we were looking for our dogs and please keep an eye out. And so before long, I had two or three people leaving the parking lot saying, "I'll be back in just a minute. I have a charcoal cooker. I will bring it for you." People brought us meat, packaged meat, elk meat, sausage, hot dogs, bacon. But by 3 a.m, we realized this is kind of crazy. They're not here yet. Let's just put the fire out. We'll come back tomorrow. So we did that a second night, too.
Those nights were the worst nights of my life. It was terrible.
I was in the car watching them get this, like, cookout set up at, like, 9 p.m. in the dark. And I was like, this is absolutely insane. Like, I'm just going through the motions now to make my parents feel good. I really didn't feel like they were alive at that point.
We would come home every night and everyone would go to their room. And I remember I would just go into my room and cry. I had given up hope. But I would always imagine the call that I would get. "We have your dogs. They're worse for the wear, but they're okay." So that was not that dissimilar than the real phone call that we got.
My name is Chuck Amon.
And I'm Dawn Huffer, married to Chuck. We arrived out there on, I believe it was the 27th, and we were staying at the hostel in Winthrop and went to one of the little grocery stores there, and I saw the flyer on the way out saying, "Lost poodles, lost since the 22nd, and I remember making a comment to Chuck saying, "Oh my goodness, that's been a long time already. That doesn't sound good."
When we were coming back from our ski tour on the 31st, and we were coming down the road, and Dawn pointed out that she saw two dogs on the ridge line.
I knew instantly it was a poodle standing up, and then I saw the movement of another, and that's when I said, "It's the poodles!" Went into town and ran into the store, and I'm dialing all the phone numbers that are on the flyer. There were three of them for Darcy and Jerry and Beverly. No one answered the first time through, but I left a message on Beverly's phone.
She was adamant that it was two poodles. She said, "Two standard poodles. I just know that's what I saw." And I said to Jerry and Darcy, "We've got to go. We have to go." So we hopped in the car, and it was 7 minutes away, literally, from where we were. And by then, Dawn and Chuck were there meeting us.
And I remember I stepped off the road into the field, and my foot sunk down, and the snow went all the way up to, like, my belly button. So imagine I'm trudging through this, like, waist-deep snow down a hill and back up onto this ridge, and I'm calling their names. And I think first I heard really faint whimpers, and then I can, like, I get a little closer and I see, like, a tail, this, like, short little nubby tail wagging, and it's them. And I yell back to the road, "It's them."
And I started jumping up and down, and I was sobbing and crying, but holding on to Dawn, and she's real tall, and I had to reach way up and grab her shoulders, and we were just hugging each other.
They were so skinny, and I could smell their pee was, like, all over the place, and I could see in the snow little wells where they had been sleeping.
They had dug down. It was apparent they must have been there before the big storm that Friday and had dug into the dirt two patches right next to each other. And there's a little footpath, it looks like, that goes in a circle. So to keep warm, they walked in circles for about at least 4 or 5 days, and they weren't cold. I think they kept each other warm.
I came away, and I had this moment in the middle of those 9 days where I thought, if we don't find these dogs, I will feel so fulfilled just by all these people who have, you know, spent their Christmas morning helping us look. Or there were people who were on snowshoes with us every single day. And you're rarely in a situation where you get to see the lengths that people will go for other people in times of distress.
The walkers nursed their poodles back to health and were told the dogs are doing great, though a little less enthusiastic about snowy adventures in the country. That story was produced by Ashley Ahern. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme this week is City Slickers. Rashina Fountain and Tiffany Adams met at Antioch University in Seattle, where they were both working for their master's degrees. Rashina grew up on the west side of Chicago. Tiffany is from downtown New York, and they quickly found they had a shared interest in nature. Before long, they were helping each other. Tiffany encouraged Rashina's newfound love of birding, and Rashina cheered Tiffany on in her studies. And that support was important, considering that birding is not the most obvious passion for a young African-American woman from a big city. They sat down together for a conversation in our studio. Tiffany kicked things off.
I grew up in New York City in the housing projects downtown, and I've always had an interest in wildlife and conservation. I just didn't really have the outlets to really pursue that growing up because it was very stressful. I grew up with my mom, and she struggled with addiction all my life. And so it was pretty stressful growing up in the projects and had to be mostly a caretaker at such a young age. And so, like, childhood and playing and having friends was like, it didn't happen. And so through that experience, I had to find some type of peace and some type of escape. And for me, my way of connecting to nature was through National Geographic and Discovery Channel. And I always wanted to be the people taking pictures and the people in the Serengeti. And I'm just like, man, I want to do that. And I didn't see people who look like me, but I still wanted to be that. And so I started out birding, and I started out in Central Park, and that really awakened me to possibilities as far as career, and just awakened the passion that I had since I was little.
Can you talk a little bit more about that transition from National Geographic and then discovering birding as your passion?
I found a bird watching group that met in Central Park. And that first day I went, it was the height of migration, around mid-April. And I was the only black girl there. I didn't have any binoculars, no field guide. I just had my little point and shoot camera and my enthusiasm. What do people think you do in the environmental field? Family, friends?
Like, sure. I don't think my family really knows what I do. They know that I make a living and that I'm doing okay. I have an apartment. And so they know that, but in terms of, I heard my mom brag about me and my brother, because my brother, he has a master's degree in social work. And she was like, you know, I was telling my friends that my kids are doing well. You know, your brother has a master's degree in social work and you are doing something, you know. And so I don't think so. So I have a master's degree as well. But she doesn't quite get the concept of like what I do. And I've tried to explain it and say, you know, I work in the environmental field, but, you know, she calls me her little hippie and thinks that I'm like maybe going on forest hikes every day or doing, I don't know what she thinks I do. But I think that that's, you know, part of the reason why I'm really drawn to being in the environmental field is because I want people from like cities. And, you know, my mom grew up in, you know, on the west side of Chicago, and her concept of like what nature is and what environmental field is scoped by the mainstream perception of what that is. And so when I say something about environment, she's picturing somebody chained to a tree, probably trying to save one tree or something like that.
You know, I kind of expect those comments. When I was little, I asked my mom, like, Mom, how come there's no black people studying animals? And my mom, she was like, oh, black people, we don't do that. We don't mess with animals. You know, I really thought about that. I mean, especially once I became a birder, I was like, wow, you know, this is not just for like retired white people. This is for everyone, you know? And so my thing is that representation is so important, because there's young kids out there that really want to do something that's different, that's out of the box. A lot of the kids out there need role models and people who look like them.
A lot of times there is a pressure to be a specific way into, you know, I'm a DJ, and I have been into hip hop. I write poetry and all. And at times, you know, I thought getting more serious in my career and getting more professional meant leaving those things behind. And that's one thing I was saying I admire about you, is that you're like, you yourself, like no matter where you are, you bring your whole entire self. It's something that I think is important in terms of representation and being a black woman in the environmental field and not muting any culture or anything like that in order to fit into a box, because then that negates people seeing themselves in me. And that's what I hope happens, that people can see themselves in me, because at times I was desperately looking to see myself in other people. And when I did, that motivated me, and that meant the world to me.
What would you say to the young Black girl who aspires to be an environmentalist but doesn't see much representation?
You know, that there's a first for everything, but luckily she doesn't have to be the first, because the more I got into the field, the more I said out loud what I wanted to do, I found that there were others, you know, that had already carved a path. So I think I would say you're not the only one with that passion, and to listen to that voice that you have that is telling you to follow that route. And you don't have to prove to anyone. You already have a right to be there. And it's not impossible, because there are others that have come before us. And so, yeah, I would say listen to that voice and follow your path. And you know, it's already been carved for you.
Rashina Fountain is a digital communications manager with the Environmental Leadership Program, and Tiffany Adams is a STEM instructor and a naturalist with Seattle Parks. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week our theme is city slickers. In a city, all over the place, there are signs. They tell us what's allowed and where we're supposed to be. They're such a common feature of the urban landscape that we often look right past them. But if you're in Seattle and you keep your eyes peeled, you might encounter an official-looking directive from the city on sheet metal that actually tells you something completely unexpected. This happened to Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing.
Early one morning, when the grass was still full of dew on what was going to be a pretty nice day, I was walking my dog Coco in Wallingford Park, one hand on the leash, the other holding my cup of coffee, and there's a sign that reminds me every day that no dogs are allowed in this park ever. And on this morning, there was another sign attached to the fence, but it was different, and it said this: "Caution, if I could love anyone again, it would be you." This looked really official. It was black and yellow, kind of the same dimensions as the no dogs in the park sign. And these are really bold words. "Caution, if I could love anyone again, it would be you." It just took me back to those intense feelings you have in high school, unrequited love. And at the bottom of the sign, in really tiny script, was a web address, and it led me to a woman named April Soderman.
Official public signs are like very serious. They're like, no trespassing, no, like, please don't feed the birds. Like,
yeah, there's very few signs that actually tell you to do something, right? You make a really good point. They're usually telling us not to do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually for safety reasons, right? And what does it mean to put something that's more emotional or more of a reminder, or even just like something that didn't get to be said? What does it mean to put those on signs and then leave them in the public space?
April makes metal signs that look like they were created by the city, and then puts them in places where people might encounter them. It's pretty subtle guerrilla art. The first sign she put in a park was a notice sign.
"Notice, I never stopped loving you. I hope you're well."
What are some of the other ones that you've put out there?
Security, "I thought my future would have had you in it." That one is actually a little rough. Oh yeah, this one where I put a warning, no trespassing, next to a warning, beware of feelings sign. So official sign next to my unofficial sign.
They look exactly the same except for the words.
Yeah.
When April talks about her work at events for artists and designers like this one that happened in San Francisco, she says she doesn't really like words.
"They're my least comfortable medium, but turns out most people use them to communicate. And a lot of them are embarrassingly personal, but it's easier to be genuine when you're anonymous."
April likes to keep the locations of where her signs are anonymous, too. I meet up with her in a park in Seattle.
I mean, should we say where we are, or?
Park in Seattle.
We're in a park in Seattle.
Very popular park in Seattle.
A very popular park in Seattle, okay. And we are, what are we doing?
Installing another gorilla art piece.
We're walking up to check and see if one of your signs remains in the park that we're in.
We pass by an empty wading pool. We get closer to our destination.
It's still up. Yeah.
You just know from this distance that it's yours?
Oh, yeah.
The red and white metal sign that she installed several months ago is still here.
And it, from a distance from where we are, I guess we're like 30 feet away from it right now. And from a distance, it looks like it's a warning sign to tell people not to go over this fence because on the other side is a reservoir full of our drinking water. But when you get closer, I need glasses. When you get closer, it says, what does it say?
Attention, you are wonderful and deserve every happiness.
So it's not telling you to not climb the fence. It's like, it's giving you this little, it's almost like a little gift.
A little reminder, you know. And I wanted to make sure it said like every happiness, not just like you deserve to be happy is different, you know, like that you deserve to be happy because versus like, oh, you can be happy in this way, but you can't in this way. It's like, no, you deserve every happiness.
Do you want these signs to trigger memories for people?
I think that's why they actually work is because they do trigger memories for people. I think especially with the notice sign, I never stopped loving you. I hope you're well. It's because a lot of people would either place themselves in the you or like they have a you that comes to mind. And I think that's why they work is because it tries to hit something that's more universally felt.
Who comes to mind for you when you...
Oh, I'm not going to say that one.
I'm sensing some boundary and intimacy issues.
It's one of those where, like, again, it's very easy to be honest when you're anonymous. It's like leaving it behind on the sign.
So you understand the power of words.
I'm trying to get better. Yeah.
April knows that where words appear, how large or small they are, what font they're in, it can all have a certain power. And April, she puts words on everything, metal, paper, even food. Small gestures of affection are stamped on little heart candies. Instead of I love you or be mine, April says things like,
I like your face, or you smell nice.
April says she would never put these sentences in a card. She says that would be too awkward and too permanent. And she takes power away from negative thoughts by putting them on small slips of paper and tucking them into little cookies. She calls them her misfortune cookies.
This sounds terrible, but one says, for example, in a fortune cookie, it says she never really loved you. Or it says, like, if you just tried a little harder, it would have worked out. Like, it doesn't shape your life, you know? And it's sort of like not giving these things that are our insecurities, not giving them the power to, like, shape our lives. For example, though, I would never put that on a street sign and leave it out. Because that's like hitting someone in the face. One of the personal rules I have for, like, the public art pieces are maybe bittersweet or melancholy, but never bitter. Like, they're either, like, encouraging or, you know, maybe a little sad, but they're never, like, angry or trying to attack somebody. Because, like, that's the last thing I want to do.
Just like the heart candies she makes or the misfortune cookies, April's metal signs are not permanent. People who spot them and who are smitten often return with scissors or pliers to clip a sign from a fence and claim it as their own. The sign that I spotted in Wallingford Park, it disappeared ages ago. For now, April isn't putting up any more street signs. Her future words will need a bigger home. She says at some point, she is going to need a billboard.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. This is Sound Effect from 88.5. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're telling stories of city slickers. Now we're going to meet a group of people who arrived in the Northwest with visions of creating a whole new city in the middle of the Oregon desert. They would describe themselves as a religion. Many have called them a cult. They were followers of an enigmatic Indian guru named Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. The followers of the Bhagwan, known as Sinyasins, are chronicled in a new Netflix documentary series called Wild, Wild Country.
Those who were at the ranch tend to share a bond. So maybe like going through war together or something, you know? You share a bond of having gone through an extremely intense experience. Love.
In the early 1980s, the Oregonian newspaper out of Portland covered the Sinyasins' arrival at Big Muddy Ranch. Reporter Les Zeitz followed its transformation into a full-fledged city.
You had a medical clinic, you had a fire department, you had a police department, they had their own airline with DC-3s coming and going, they had a disco, they had sports courts, they had three or four different types of restaurants. You know, they had a transportation system. It was a bustling little metropolis out there.
The story Zeitz was covering quickly transformed from a curiosity into an epic drama, complete with massive fraud, betrayal, and plots to commit murder. Even Zeitz himself was told that he was a marked man. And behind it all was a figure that loomed even larger than the guru himself, Ma Anand Sheela. Les Zeitz told us about her when we reached him by Skype.
So Sheela grew up in what would in India be considered a privileged family in a city called Baroda. She eventually migrated down to Bombay, where Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was gathering his fame and his flock. She became enamored with him and with his organization and eventually worked her way into becoming his personal secretary, which really meant she became his chief of staff, and then from her perch as chief of staff, she engineered the flight from India to wind up in Oregon.
What did that mean exactly? What kind of responsibilities did she have, and what was her role on the commune?
Well, she was in charge. This was it had turned into a multi-million dollar global enterprise. It was moving vast sums of money and vast numbers of people, and Sheela was in charge of it all.
This is how everything in Rajneeshpuram functioned. Bhagwan said something to me, I said yes. I said something to the people, they said yes.
Our religion is probably the only religion which has synthesized capitalism and religion together.
And what were some of the things that were going on behind the scenes that were invisible from the outside and maybe not even clear at the time to you?
Well, as we now know, it developed at the top into a tremendous criminal enterprise. You had, as we know, widespread immigration fraud. In other words, they were bringing in wealthy sannyasins from around the world, marrying them up with American citizens to award them citizenship and allow them to stay in the country. You had these efforts to overwhelm the political structure by increasingly more dangerous approaches. This is what led to the poisoning of 10 salad bars in a town called the Dalles, where sannyasins very deliberately went into the restaurants and sprinkled salmonella on the salad bars. And at least 750 people were taken deathly ill by this stunt. This was a dry run to see if they could suppress voter turnout enough to let their numbers overwhelm local voters, so to speak, and take control of a county, to blunt the investigations that were unfolding against them. They put together a list of people that they targeted for assassination. That included very active plans to assassinate the then United States attorney who was handling the immigration and federal charges, the Oregon attorney general who was investigating the conflation of religion and state that was represented by the creation of the city of Rajneeshpuram, and then people like myself, people who were just asking questions and not taking a no for an answer.
So obviously you made it. Oh, okay. But
how, I liked the bullet, yes.
Yeah. But how far did some of these assassination plots actually get?
Two of them got fairly advanced. One of them was against the guru's personal doctor, Swami Devaraj, a gentleman from England. He was actually stabbed with a poisoned ring and felled with poison and came very close to dying. He was considered an opponent to Sheila within the organization, and he had the guru's ear, so he was considered a threat on the inside. On the outside, they went so far on the plot to assassinate the U.S. attorney that they sent two sannyasins to Texas to buy guns to bring back that couldn't be traced. And at one point, apparently, were quite close to putting their plan into play to shoot him to death in a downtown parking garage.
So what was her ultimate downfall? How did this end for her in Oregon?
Well, the external pressures and the internal pressures set in motion events that led to the collapse of the commune. Sheila understood that this empire was crumbling and that she was in substantial legal exposure. So she and a handful of her top lieutenants fled Oregon, went overseas, and hid in Germany for quite some time. As the investigations wrapped up, the indictments came down. Oregon and federal authorities found her in Germany, arrested her, brought her back. She pleaded guilty, served like 2.5 years in a federal prison in California, and then after that went overseas and hasn't been back since.
But that wasn't the last you saw of her, right?
No.
Can you describe the meeting that you had with her, I guess, decades later?
Well, fast forward to 2011. I'm at the Oregonian. It's the 25th anniversary of the collapse of the commune. And I decided to see if Sheila would talk at all about those early days in Oregon. I tracked her down to a small city in Switzerland, about 2 hours outside of Zurich, where she now owns and manages two elderly group care homes, which is hard to imagine. In any event, Sheila consented to me coming over and talking with her. I traveled over there, drove out across the Swiss countryside, drove up to the group home, and Sheila came out and welcomed me like a long-lost friend. It was a very pleasant reacquaintance, as it were. She had aged. I had aged. It was all very cordial. On my last night there, we went to a dinner in Germany, and I finally got around to asking the question that I had been burning to ask her since I got there. I turned to her and said, Sheila, but before we go, because we were pretty much done, I said, I just have to ask you, why did you put me on the hit list? And she got to smile and just very quietly laughed and said, oh, you were never on any hit list. And that was all she would say about it.
Do you believe her?
No, I do not.
Les Zeitz covered the Rajneeshi commune for the Oregonian in the 1980s. These days, he lives on a ranch and publishes a weekly newspaper in Central Oregon. And special thanks to Scott Harris for sharing this rare archival recording. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5. We're going to wrap up with the story of a city slicker searching for some kind of truth out in the empty landscapes of America. John Roderick is the frontman for the indie band The Long Winters. Before he was a professional musician, Roderick was just a kid growing up in Seattle and Anchorage, a kid with dreams of wandering, breaking free, hitting the open country. Well, Roderick did live that dream in a way that was bold and fearless and occasionally clownishly inept. It all stemmed from a lifelong fascination that was first sparked in the middle of the city.
It actually happened at the Woodland Park Zoo when I was a little kid. There was a train, like a train you could ride. There was an engineer. It was a little steam train that went completely around the zoo. You could take a kind of tour of the zoo on this train. But when I was 8 years old, I started to hide in the bushes and wait for the train to come along. And I would run along behind and jump on and hold on to the back of the train. And then it escalated. I started to have a cap gun and put a bandana over my nose and run along behind the train and jump and then, you know, say, "It's a train robbery." And, you know, I was eight. So adults in the 1970s were a lot more tolerant of that kind of unsupervised mischief. Growing up in Alaska, you're an American. You know you're an American. But you're also thousands of miles away from America. So we fetishized America. And this was during the era of MTV and the... And you'd watch these music videos of Bruce Springsteen or John Cougar Mellencamp. And they're depicting this America of, you know, high school football games and a kind of Midwestern cult during the 80s. And from Alaska, it all looked so exotic. It was as exotic as looking at a movie about Europe. And so I started to imagine traveling in America as a thing that... where there was a lot of wisdom to be found there, hitchhiking and going from state to state. And that's part of the American mythos, too, that you're a poor writer and you stick out your thumb and you go find the real America or find yourself. I graduated from high school and it was kind of almost a surprise. I expected that I wouldn't graduate. I got a one-way ticket to Seattle, and I came down with a friend, and we were going to set off across America. I was kind of looking for that thing. How can I be my most natural self, uncompromised by, you know, this, like, gradual chipping away at one's authentic humanness by these indignities, these small indignities? Your grade cards and your power bills. You know, all this stuff that feel like indignities to a young person. I did want to achieve as close to a state of freedom as I could. We stuck our thumbs out. And we made it down to Tacoma, and we were sitting on the side of the road with our thumbs out. And we realized we were right across the street from the Tacoma Yard. And we were watching these freight trains come and go. And this gradual dawning... like, there's no fence between us and the rail yard. There's nothing keeping us off those trains. And then the world went from black and white to color. You know, our minds were flooded with all these secondhand memories of hobos traveling across America. And so we walked across the street and at first really tentatively kind of hopped up on a boxcar and looked around, and there wasn't anybody there to see us. It took us a while to get on a train that was actually doing something other than just moving around the yard. We spent a couple of hours just getting shuttled around from track to track. But eventually we got on a train and it headed out of town, and it was just rainbows. Because the train immediately goes somewhere where the roads don't. It was more than I expected. It was better than I expected. Because it really was free. And it's like you're riding an animal. Like a prehistorically sized animal that no one else has the chutzpah to ride. And when that first train came to the Columbia River in Vancouver, Washington, it stopped. And we panicked. And we jumped off, and the train took off and went across the bridge over to Oregon. And so in the middle of the night, we crossed that railroad bridge over the Columbia, which there's no, like, sidewalk. It's just a railroad. And so about halfway across that bridge, another train came, and we had to sort of grab onto the girders of the bridge and swing our bodies out over the river and hold on, because there wasn't room for... us and the train to be on the bridge at the same time. And then later that night, we realized it was too far to walk to Portland. We were exhausted. And so we found a big field and pitched our little Boy Scout tent that we'd brought from Alaska. And when we woke up in the morning, we realized that we had pitched our tent in a landfill. We were on a section of it that had been kind of covered with a little layer of dirt, but we were awoken by big bulldozers and stuff moving fresh garbage around. And you can imagine what the bulldozer operators thought, this little pup tent and two teenagers, you know, poking their heads out in the early morning, surrounded literally by hot garbage. I mean, realizing how big the country was and how little I knew about it. I mean, I'd memorized all 50 states and capitals, but I couldn't picture it in my mind as I was embarking upon it. So the next train I jumped on in Portland took me to Duluth, Minnesota, and it took 3 days. The train went through a landscape at one point where it was a garbage dump of tires, old truck tires and car tires, but it seemed like the tires went on these rolling hills as far as the eye could see in every direction. And growing up in Alaska, I couldn't have imagined such a place existed. And this was a place where tires had caught fire and were just smoldering for, you know, some places where they just could never get to the bottom of the tire pile enough to put them out. So it was just like, it was almost like Mordor. And I did get to places where there were hay bales and windmills and high school football games. And in that, it exceeded my expectations. You know, America is bigger and more beautiful and more mysterious. A few years later, I was down in the freight yard down by Georgetown. And there were trains getting set up, you know, freight trains getting set up in the yard. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, the trains. And I went down into the yard just to be close to them and feel that energy. And I got down there and they're terrifying. A freight train in the middle of the night, like, they're enormous and really scary. And I'm standing on there, and I wasn't that much older. You know, I was in my late 20s by that point. But I couldn't recapture what I had been thinking, what kind of fearlessness I must have had. It isn't just that I'm a homeowner now and a 50-year-old man with a kid who's compromised all of his youthful ideals. It's that it feels like a different life.
John Roderick lives in Seattle, where he makes music and podcasts, none of which are about trains. That's it for today's Sound Effect. Our show is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Our intern is Janae Janik, and Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You'll never miss an episode when you subscribe to our podcast, or you can tell your smart speaker, play Sound Effect, the podcast. And we love to get your feedback on our Facebook page or by emailing soundeffect@knkx.org. Come on back next week when our theme is barflies. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.